Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 108, being recorded on the 23rd of December, 2015. My name is Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me, I have Kale Teeter. Looks like Evan's on vacation today, so it's just you and me, Kale. And we hope to cover, the topic for today came about because of some feedback we received from one of our Twitter followers, and he had asked that we cover the Service Fabric a little more in detail. We have covered it before, but I think it was kind of glossed over, and what we'll try and do today is to maybe spend just focused time on some of the scenarios covered by Service Fabric so that our listeners understand why that's important and how that fits into the grand scheme of things as it relates to both on-premises as well as Azure. Sounds good to you?
Yep, that sounds good.
And thank you for putting some updates in the show notes. As usual, we'll start with that. Something that you'd like to cover, Kale?
Yeah, there's a couple of them, but one of the big ones this week was we had a guest on here a while back. His name was Charles Joy. He was a PM on the Azure Stack product that's being worked on. And so this week there was actually an announcement about some hardware requirements for the preview release. I don't know if we have a date out there when the preview release is coming out, but there's a blog post out here that can actually reach out to say, you know, one of the goals with the tech preview or this early version of Azure Stack that will be released is kind of like POC type stuff. So the idea was to kind of give people a sense for, you know, here's kind of a recommendation on a machine to be able to really show this thing off in like a POC type environment. So from the storage, you know, and including the CPU memory and some of the recommendations around networking, so that you can really take advantage of this and show the power of what this thing can do.
Oh, okay. And I think they haven't committed to a date yet, I believe, for the preview. It's still, I think the broad understanding is probably the first quarter of 2016. And so definitely looking forward to that. I know my customer is very keen on getting their hands on that. So it's good that they at least got some hardware requirements to get something they can start looking at right away.
Yep.
And then we got the new September update for web apps. Is this September? Is that what it says?
Yeah, September. There were some new updates for the web apps and app service environments.
Okay.
So if you go out, I mean, there's a couple things to kind of dive into here. One would be, you know, now we have support for .NET 4.6, so the new framework. And that kind of ties in... I didn't do this on purpose, but that kind of ties into one other of the messages we might as well talk about right now, was the support ending for some of the .NET frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
In January 12th, which is coming up real soon, a couple weeks here, the .NET 4, 4.5, and 4.5.1 are going to be end of life, or support ending for them.
Right.
Not end of life, but the support ending. And, you know, a couple people have asked me about this because we have 4.2, we have 4.6, or 4.5.2, we have 4.6, and people are saying, well, what's the deal with this? And if you take a look out there on the internet, and we'll put one link out there, but there's a lot of Microsoft articles around this, the idea is, you know, those are kind of, you know, patches or security things as it went up through those ranks of 4, 4.5, and then the other dot releases. And the idea is to not be supporting so many of those that are down level.
Right.
Is one aspect of it, yeah.
Okay, and as a matter of fact, since we're talking about things that are ending support, I think the one that I caught, probably one of the emails that came in earlier from the Azure folks, that I think they go out to all the subscribers, was the caching service, right? The shared, there's a couple of things that are going to be stop at the end of this year, the end of 2016, I should say. So I know it's still plenty of time, but customers that are still using the caching service, the shared cache, and have to move on to the Redis caching service as soon as possible. I think within the next year, that'll be gone.
That was our managed cache offering before we had. Is that what
Right,
you're speaking of? Yeah.
that's
Okay.
correct, yeah. And so I think that just a reminder email that came out recently saying, hey, if you're still on it, you gotta move off it.
Cool. Yeah, and then back to, the framework thing kind of diverged there, but we support 4.6 now for the web apps and API or the app service environments. And then there's also the Process Explorer is actually in the portal now. So before, like if you were on like a web app, you could go into the Kudu environment and
Correct.
you could kind of get some of this information from inside of there. But now it's kind of been pushed back out into the portal. So you don't have to go into yet another environment to see that kind of stuff.
Right. Nice, very nice. And then you've got something about open source in Azure, some series on Channel 9, is that?
Yeah, this kind of struck me out. I know Keith Mayer is a big contributor here. There's a couple people that speak on this, but we were speaking about this last week. I think it was around some of the open source technologies and how we use them, and different clouds and all that type of stuff. And with the whole Linux theme of we've kind of embraced running Linux workloads through many different distros. There's a big series up there actually on Channel 9 around Azure and open source. So people, I just wanted to kind of follow up because we had talked about that recently. And if you're interested in that, there's a whole series up there on Channel 9 that's really good. It kind of walks through, what we kind of do up there and all the different aspects of how open source and Linux are run in Azure.
I see, and that this is, I guess, Linux is getting a lot of attention recently, right? We just talked last week about the certification, right? The Azure certification for Linux. So it looks like definitely throwing a lot of weight behind Linux, which is pretty good. Very, very excited about all that.
Makes it good for migrations and cross-platform development, that kind of thing, because the whole world doesn't run on IIS, unfortunately.
As much as we'd like to tell them. Yeah, and then you've got something about some free online training for big data and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's another, and this is part of our MBAs. So if you haven't heard of them, they're Microsoft Virtual Academies. They're really good. So they'll walk through a series. There's a ton of series up there. So if you just go up to mba.microsoft.com, there's tons of them up there on everything from gaming to Azure stuff. And this one happens to be on big data and some of the different tools that we have around that and some of the ways to use it. So I thought it was really interesting, and I went through some of it myself. But it's very good if you're just getting started with big data and trying to understand what all these terms are and what tools we have.
Nice, very nice. Thanks for all this. And we'll put all those links in the show notes, of course. So let's get right to it then. We're trying to try to dig a little deeper into Service Fabric. And obviously, I think I'm sure listeners know that this is one of my favorite topics. And it should be something that most listeners should be aware of because this is the future of PaaS as we know it. We've had PaaS, I think pretty much the very first service offering we had when we when Azure started, and that was it had a lot of good things, but it also had a lot of limitations. And over time, they've reinvented PaaS into this new. I don't want to call it PaaS V2, but it's a new incarnation of PaaS. And I think we need to talk about a little bit about it because it gives you a lot of options, a lot of provisions, and it makes life a lot easier for you as a developer and as somebody who has to think about hosting their applications. At the same time, it comes with a little bit of responsibility that you have to stick to certain programming models. And as we've discussed in the past, there are these two programming models. One of them is called the actor model, and the other one's called the service model, referred to as reliable actors and reliable services. And get in a minute as to why they're called reliable, but Do you remember back in your college days about the actor model, Kale? Is that something that you recall studying? Because it's something that they talk about in some computer science courses, but I don't think a lot of people remember what it actually does.
Yeah, I don't know that that's something, I haven't seen it, especially in just day-to-day work recently. A lot of people using it, but it's something that I think is making a resurgence here, especially with the cloud, because it makes sense for some of these microservices and that model fitting in here.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that's a good area to talk about as well, because Service Fabric is essentially a microservice platform. I think Microsoft figured out that building complicated applications as monolithic applications, like multi-tier, web, middle, and back, is limiting when it comes to scalability, reliability, and so on and so forth. So they've adopted. They knew that microservices solves the problem of building these very complex applications because they're basically a bunch of small purpose-built services that can call other services, and each of them has a well-defined endpoint, and you could and there's a place where you can go to find out where that service is, what the name is, and call it. But the problem is that there is in order to make these easy to scale, make them more reliable, make them more scalable, you need a lot of infrastructure. Okay, and typically applications have to build all that infrastructure into their own app, or they have to build their own frameworks, possibly on top of .NET or whatever, Java or whatever else they're using, to achieve this level of flexibility and reliability. Instrumentation, etc. And Microsoft thought there's no point in reinventing this wheel for every application. They need to provide a framework or a runtime that does all of this, and then application developers simply write apps to a bunch of specific models. Okay, and we can talk about the two models that one is the Actor framework and the other one is the Reliable Service framework. So that's what Service Fabric is. Okay? It's a microservice platform at its heart.
Yeah, I think the thing there, two things. One is, I don't think this is a concept that's foreign to people, especially if you've been building large scale applications, even on-prem before there was a cloud was popular. I think it's a common programming model. Even just forget about services, just think about your application. If you were building an application, do you want to build just one big class and have your entire app inside of that class? From a development standpoint, that would be horrible, right? Because there's so much coupling there that you make one change and you end up breaking everything. And I think that concept of pushing that out, even into the service layer and the infrastructure itself is great, but like you said, Sajid, it was really hard to do that. Like, that's a great idea, and if there was no cloud, it would be really hard to pull that off because you have no way to, manage all these nodes and kind of orchestrate, how those things work to make them reliable and, fault resistant and all that kind of thing. So I think that, yeah, I heard this term born in the cloud, like this kind of concept is born in the cloud, and it kind of makes sense because the cloud really augments as well.
Absolutely, yes. And one of the key ideas with this new PaaS model, which we didn't talk just a bit earlier, is that you have the flexibility of deploying it on your developer machine, on your on-premises, or in the cloud. So you've got like these three options that you could use. The first one's up just to play around with. The second one, on-premises, is if you have an application that you think is too sensitive to put in the cloud for whatever reason, and you want to have it on-premise. Yes, you could use the same code that you just developed now can be put on-premises. Or if you feel like, hey, I can put this in the cloud, then you could also put it in Azure, and that's part of the preview that's available in Azure today is Service Fabric preview is. You can walk up to the portal and say, spin me up a cluster, a Service Fabric cluster, and just upload all your code that you've been testing. So.
Now, Sajid, before you get into the internals of it, I know I think you've been through this process at least somewhat on the, running this on your machine as well as in the cloud. Is that a big process to get going? Like, is it complicated, or is there just like an XE that I install? Does this work through Visual Studio, or?
So it's kind of a little bit all of the above, which you just mentioned. Visual Studio is a big component of Visual Studio 2015. I should mention is a big component of what we just talked about. But essentially, it's all done through the platform installer, right? The web platform installer. If you just if you're in there, you just look for Fabric, and you'll find the Surface Fabric over there. I think it's a November release, which is the most recent. And you install that, and that gives you a couple of things, right? That gives you the SDK, and that also gives you a multi-machine deployment should you wish to try that on your on-premises. Okay, so those are the two models that are available in that. Now, once you, of course, it also installs a bunch of plugins into Visual Studio so that you can manage, you can deploy your applications from inside Visual Studio. Because at some point you're going to write applications in Visual Studio using the two models I talked about, the actor model or the service model, and then you'd want to run it. And there is no emulator as such, right? The service fabric that is installed on your machine is the actual service fabric. It's just a single machine install for development purposes, and you and the Visual Studio will now deploy it to that single machine install on your machine. And you can do full debugging, full round trip testing, things like that, right from inside of Visual Studio. Once you've got that working on your dev machine, you can then use a bunch of PowerShell commands to deploy that same package which you had tested on your machine to your multi-machine cluster, which is running, potentially on a bunch of high-end machines or.
Yeah, and one thing, Sajid, just to mention, if you go up to the portal, we should put a link to this for the Service Fabric to get started with it. There's a nice kind of walkthrough up there of, how to get started and a little bit more detail other than what we can cover in a short time here. But one of the things that stood out was, there's a lot of Linux stuff featured here, and that's why I was asking about the installation. But it seems like with our initial release here, the preview, there's a lot of tooling that's been built around, this is an API that we're going to call into essentially, but there's a lot of tooling that's been built in Visual Studio. But I think maybe one of the things we can do is actually we can host this thing on Linux. The actual containers, like run our ASP.NET code inside of there with some of the new things we have.
Well, the ASP.NET 5, of course, we've talked about before, and the vNext stuff that can run on Linux. I may be wrong, but as far as I know, this the Surface Fabric right now only runs on Windows currently, and of course it runs in the cloud, right in Azure. So where and I guess out there you don't really care where what operating system it is,
What the
but.
machine is? Yeah,
Yeah,
okay.
yeah. But right now, I think this is only on Windows, and of course, you could access it. What they're trying to do is they're trying to make it such that. So it's a part of the problem of creating these reliable services and reliable actors, and we'll talk about those two models in just a second, is how do you access them no matter whether the machines are up or down? Because you have a bunch of machines out there that are running your service or your actors, and you're trying to connect to them. Your application is your client application. And some of them may be up, some of them may be down, some of them may be up being upgraded right now to a new version, and your application needs to always keep running. And so there's a lot of infrastructure in here which helps you locate the correct instance of your application or your service so that you can connect into it. And so that requires a lot of client-side interaction with the naming service that the Azure Service Fabric offers so that they're able to locate your exact the correct instance of your service or your actor. But the problem is that you do require this client-side code to interact with the service with the Service Fabric runtime so that it can find all these correct instances, etc. And running that from a non-Windows platform would mean that all those client-side APIs now have to be made available on Linux or in some other platform, and they haven't done that yet. So
I
right
see.
now, if you do connect from a Linux as a client, you can connect in into a, just a regular HTTP endpoint or TCP endpoint, if that may be the case, but you'll lose some of this very dynamic naming option. You'll just get a URL, right? Just like we do today, you get a web URL, and then so you're at the mercy of the DNS system to resolve, make sure that that resolves correctly to a machine that is up, and so that failover thing will not be available to you. Yeah,
That's a
the
good
dynamic
point.
field. Yeah. So right now, I think both the client and the server have to be on Windows and have to be participating in this Service Fabric API.
Okay.
That's a very
Now
good, point. Yeah.
you mentioned just kind of get back to diving in a little bit here, the two different models. There's an actor and a service. Maybe you could what's the difference between the two?
Sure. Yeah, and that's really the key thing I think that I struggle to understand, and most people who want to adopt this new PaaS model will have to understand. Okay, I think services is something that everybody understands. It's what the traditional definition of services is. You can think of it as a web API service or a WCF service. We have all these services in the PaaS. Essentially, that's all the same. That concept is still the same. It's a long-running application that you can have endpoints in, methods in, and applications, client applications can connect into those methods. Okay. Let me talk about the actors first because that's a little new over here. So actors are essentially standalone .NET components. Okay, they're just simple .NET POCO components that have some methods on them, and you want to be able to call those methods and execute them. But the restriction is that those methods are treated as that entire object or instance is treated as a single-threaded instance. I think you may be familiar from the COM days with the word STA or single-threaded apartment, and it is an actor is essentially a .NET single-threaded apartment. It only allows one method to be running on an instance of that object. Okay, so if you have an actor A and it's got a bunch of methods M1 and M2, if anyone is calling M1 in an instance of A, nobody else can call, say, M2 or another could call M1 again. If somebody does call, they have to wait for M1 to finish before M2 can get running, and the system will queue it for you. It doesn't reject the call. You're just kept in queue waiting for the M1 to finish before M2 can activate. Now you could have a second instance of the actor that's running, and you could call M1 on that one. Right, so you can have multiple instances of these actors all running, and each one of them can run in parallel. But each actor the runtime is going to ensure that it's a single-threaded unit of execution. And so what this does is, for a developer, they don't have to worry about anything multi-threaded, right? They can just focus on their business logic. They're not going to have to worry about doing any locking or anything of that fancy stuff that you and I normally have to deal with on a day-to-day basis when we write applications today. It's a simple .NET component that has methods, and you're just taking some input and returning some output. Okay.
So from a high level, it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds to me like it's okay, we have an interface, or we have some sort of code that we interact with here for this actor model, and as part of that, it's kind of going to help us out. So we inherit from that, we build what's important for us for what the concept of the actor is, and we call methods on that. But when we're doing that, we're calling those methods through this special runtime or this service fabric, which is then going to say, I have multiple of these, maybe for redundancy or scale out, but your guy that you're looking for, please go to this node right here, and that's where you're going to execute it. And that will just seamlessly happen for me, and then just give me the output, and I don't have to worry about whether there's two instances of it running and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes, the client gets to decide, first of all, whether it wants to create a new instance or it wants to connect to an existing instance. Maybe it had created an instance in the earlier part of the application, a client application, and now it wants to connect to the same instance, or it wants to connect to a brand new instance. It gets to decide that, but it doesn't need to know where that instance is or where that instance will be created. It just knows that the runtime is going to either give it the correct instance or create a brand new instance for it and give it a handle to it. And then it calls a method. It's just like today, there's essentially a client proxy that is used, but it's a special Service Fabric client proxy. Okay, so if you are building a component, you have to, as you mentioned, you have to first implement the iActor interface, and then that's all you have to do. You just create your methods that you want to expose out through this actor. Now, as people always ask me, it's like, what good is an actor if it's single-threaded? Like, how useful can that be? And this is the part that takes a little bit of understanding. It's actually very useful if it's used in the right way. Let me give you an example. Let's suppose we have a very simple image conversion we want to do, right? We take some sort of a GIF file or a JPEG file, and we have to convert it into some other image format. Typically, that doesn't take too long. It's something that you can give it to a component, and you call a method, say convert, and that's the end of it, right? It's going to convert it and return back. It doesn't have to do. There's no multi-threaded thing involved. There's nothing. It's all a self-contained operation. So this is an example of a stateless actor. Actors come in two forms: stateless and stateful. Okay, a stateless actor doesn't really care about maintaining its state. Why is state important? Let's suppose, just take the other extreme of it. Suppose I was creating an actor that did video processing. Okay, video processing, as you know, takes a little longer than an image processing. It could take more than a few seconds, maybe even minutes and hours. Now, suppose, like, in the middle of that operation, the node that you were hosted on went down, or somehow it had to be moved to another node, or something, your application had to move to another node, your actor had to be moved somewhere else. You don't want to start all over again, right? If you were stateless and you were rehydrated into another node, you'd have to start all over because there is no state. This runtime is going to say, oh, I'm going to create another instance of actor, whatever, image video converter. And oh, by the way, here's the method, and now the method is going to start all over again. But you can have a stateful actor where a certain state can be preserved in your component. And so if and when you get taken down and recreated somewhere else, you can now. You'll be put back into the same state you were where you left off. So you could continue working. So you see the difference between the two here? One is where you have a unit of work where you don't really care about the state. It's something that, it's a throwaway kind of actor. Whereas another one where you really want to make sure that in case something happens to me, I want to remember where I left off.
Yeah, I see this, Sajid, as like these were two cases we deal with every day, right? It's when we make a call to a web service and we expect to get a response, but we have no concept of updating it. If I kind of draw a correlation to something like Entity Framework, to make it simple, like, we had this thing on the client side and then we had this database and we would say like, hey, we got an instance of this thing and now we're going to do something down here in the client side and then we're going to, post that back. And so, there was some sort of state involved there. Like in that case, it just calls back and says, here's all my information. Where in this case, it's like on the server side, right? So the server can say, I have this object, like for instance, if it was a order object or something for like an ordering application or something. So like it could keep that because maybe it took a bunch of calls to the database to kind of hydrate that thing originally and said, okay, now I got all this data and now you're going to make calls into this thing to say, take that instance and update it and take that instance and do this thing with it, manipulate it. And all those things then are kind of being persisted on the back end so that if
Absolutely.
that machine dies, you're in good shape. Is that right?
Correct. That's very well put. That's kind of one of the patterns you talk about, the caching pattern to be used in actors, which is you save some information and then use it later so that you don't have to go back and recollect all that information that you had done when the actor was created.
So this is similar to, in the past, years and years ago, back even when .NET first started, we had ways to preserve state, right? So we had like, we could do it in memory on the server, and then came SQL Server where we could serialize this stuff to a database. But this sounds like it's maybe I don't have to manage it as closely. Like it's kind of the framework will take care of this for me.
Absolutely. All you tell the framework is, this is the type of my state object, And of course, as always, it has to be serializable. It has to be the data contract type of serializable. That's all. You mark it with data contract and data member. But other than that, the runtime takes care of then making sure that your state. I mean, you call APIs in your actor. You say, okay, I'm going to checkpoint my state here, and that the state gets preserved. And then later on, if something happened, it just gets put back exactly the way it was. There's
Cool.
essentially a local object, called state that's available to every actor, and you just say state dot whatever, and you get your state object. So yes, that's a very good example of that. Thank you for that. So that's an example of why you would use stateful versus stateless. Stateless ones, as I said, the very simple example that they talk on the Azure website, of course, is the simple thing of a calculator. If you have add, remove, delete, add, remove, subtract, and multiply, those are all stateless operations that, the add doesn't really care what the result of the subtract was before and things like that. There's no need to preserve any history. Now, if you want to create a calculator that does support history, like a historical, how it shows history sometimes, in that case, you would use a stateful actor because you want to save the history of that calculator actor. And so these are the two examples of using actors, and I'm sure our listeners would have caught on to the fact that these look a whole lot like microservices, right? And this is the foundation for microservices. Microservices are small units of operation that you have to do. Actors do exactly that. They are small units of operation. You don't have to worry about threading. You don't have to worry about scalability. You don't have to worry about locking. You just focus on your business logic, and the runtime gets the job done. Okay. Now, of course, actors by themselves are not very useful. They can only do a certain number of things. At the end of the day, you still need something that carries on state between different operations. Okay, and that's where a service. A reliable service comes into the picture. A service is something that is kind of running all the time. Okay, so there's some sort of persistence in memory. There's something being saved between consecutive calls. Maybe, as you said, an order, placing an order versus checking out a cart and things like that. They're all related items. A service is used in a traditional sense where you have to preserve state across multiple calls, but you also are relying on other actors. You could be relying on actors to do specific tasks. So you could have an order service, but the order service might in turn turn around and say, I need to maybe persist the order to the database. Okay, that sounds like a good job for a little actor to do. Hey, persist this. Or I need to verify someone's credit card. Oh, that sounds like another independent little bit of functionality that some other actor can do. You see, but at the same time, you're always going to need a service that kind of orchestrates the entire process together, and that's where reliable services come into the picture. Now, where reliable services differ from actors is that they have access to this thing called the reliable collection. And the reliable collection is just like we're familiar with collections, just name value pairs, but they are always available. And the reason the way they can do this and make it always available is by having copies of your data for your collection replicated across different nodes. So they call them replicas in the service fabric nomenclature. Your data, as you add items to your collection, your reliable collection, I should say, it automatically gets persisted on different nodes. So if one node goes down, and you get flipped over to another node, you don't lose that collection. That collection's your books and records today. Today, we, as you mentioned earlier, we often use SQL Server to store state, right? This is the session state of a website, for example. And you know how that can be pretty complicated, because you're worried about scalability of the database and things like that. Now, you don't need a database just for that. If it's just a simple name value pair, why use a database, right? All you're looking for is a simple collection to store somewhere. And
Yeah,
the runtime
sorry.
gives you that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I'm just thinking back of my experiences with this kind of situation. Typically, where I used to run into this, and this was even years ago, was we would fire up an application. So we'd have a pretty complex application that maybe needed some high level, let's say catalog type data or product type data inside this application. That stuff's generic, like it's the same for pretty much every user. Maybe it's filtered, but it's the same data. So in that case, it's like, okay, so what do we do with this data? Because it's not specific to this user session or this user state that they're doing, but we need it there, right? We need it fast because when we have things on the screen that we these UI elements that need that data really, really quickly. And you could do we used to do things like try to do this ourselves, where we would say, okay, like we'll go load it. So if we're on web server one, let's say we have three web servers, web server one, as soon as somebody, the first person, tries to access that and says, hey, I need to get into the catalog, it would pull that catalog down and store it in memory there. Now, any user that was hitting server one would get really fast access because it didn't have to go back to the database or whatever store we were using. But then you got the issue of like, okay, now we got to put that on multiple nodes, and then we have to coordinate changes about like when we do update that thing, how do we expire it and make sure that the other ones. And so we used to write crazy frameworks and caching things around the back end. And this, I think that seems to be the difference because we have distributed cache, right? We had Memcached, we have Redis, we have our table service. But I think the thing that's unique here is it's keeping that locally, right? It's replicating it, but keeping it locally so the speed is really fast.
It's definitely yes. It replicates across the network, and again, the same rules of serialization we discussed earlier are required here, which is has to be data contract serializable. But other than that, the system makes sure that your reliable collection is replicated, and it doesn't replicate. It doesn't pull down the whole thing, right? It kind of does some lazy loading because you might have a collection with, I don't know, 5 gigabytes of items in there. It's not going to make copies of that into every memory space, right? So it does a lot of intelligent loading of items as you're looking for them that way. But the important thing is that you're guaranteed that the collection is always going to be available. That's the key thing over here. And so caching is a good use case for that. State management, session state management is another good use case for that. Like an order, a shopping cart scenario is also a good place. A trading application might use it to for placing trades and things like that. There are so many use cases where you want to make sure that every hit to a web page, which in turn calls some service on the back end, is always going to make sure that the user state, which is part of a big workflow, is always available.
I think this is great stuff. These are, it's one of those things where it's evolution. I don't think any of these things that we discussed here even today, any of these concepts are foreign. I mean, these are things we run into on a day-to-day basis building complex applications. And I think the idea here, at least from my point of view, looking at the services, it's trying to help me deal with that so I don't have to write so much code or so much infrastructure scripts and things to keep things synchronized and up to date like that. So I think this is from that standpoint, I see this as a huge value for that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And then I just want to add a third piece to this, which is relatively new in this November release of Service Fabric that I was talking about earlier. So people may be wondering, hey, what happens if I need a web? You talked about services, you talked about actors. What about websites? The actual web engine itself. What about that? Because I need reliability there too. And now that's available in the new version of Service Fabric. You could run an ASP.NET 5 application, which could be an MVC application, for example, and it will be managed by the Service Fabric. So you'll still get advantage of some of the reliability aspects we talked about with Service Fabric offers. But at the same time, now that application, that web application, can leverage Service Fabric to call actors or to call other reliable services. So you can see how this thing all ties together, right? You've got the distributed website calling all these distributed reliable services, which are in turn calling all the distributed actors. And when you all these three things are properly configured and programmed correctly, it's a beautiful thing. It's something that essentially will never go down.
I mean, it's something hard to get your head around when you're first thinking about this. So I think I think this was great, Sajid, for you to, we kind of walked through some of the high-level components of what's involved here, but we definitely probably need to do some more diving into some of the even deeper areas of this if people are interested. So drop us a note on Twitter, but this has been, I think this has been great here, and I see great value in this. I think it's just, it's going to take a little time to get your head around all the different concepts here, yeah.
It definitely does, yeah. And I got to tell you that the Azure folks did a bang-up job with the documentation on this. The website is for Service Fabric is just phenomenal. They have it's step by step. They have labs, they have walkthroughs, they have explanation, historical data, historical background behind certain key concepts like actors, for example. They've really done a lot of work to make sure that developers understand why this actor framework and this service framework combine together to form great microservices, right? They want people to write these microservices because they believe that this is the future of writing large scalable applications. And so the first leap of faith that a lot of developers will have to do is to just adopt the microservice philosophy. And then the second step beyond that is to say, okay, what tools can I use to write microservice framework microservices? Well, the Service Fabric is one, has one offering. I mean, I'm sure there are other offerings in the open source and in the Linux world and things like that. But as far as Microsoft's concerned, this is our microservice offering.
Yeah, I think the other thing to point out is, from a dog food perspective, it's publicly, announced that Service Fabric actually powers a lot of the services we have, including, like Azure SQL Database, DocDB, Power BI, a bunch of them. They're all listed up there on the site. But this is not something where it's we built this and it's like built for some customer spec or something. We're actually using it. That's where it came from. So things inside of Azure are actually running on the same exact concept and same framework.
Not only the same concept, it's the very same bits. Yep. That's what I've been told. It's exactly the same bits that are running in Azure, running the whole Azure system. They just strip out the unnecessary parts and give us the core part just for Service Fabric. So this is very battle tested. Yep.
Well, great. I think this was great, Sajid. I know that some people have given us feedback to kind of dive into this a little bit more since it's such a complex and large ecosystem in itself. And so I said, I think this was a great overview. Maybe we could get some feedback or else we can also just dive into some pieces of it.
Yeah, we'd love to understand from our listeners if there are other key aspects of Azure that they'd like us to focus in on as well. And we'll certainly pick that up in another episode. Right. Well, Cale, I hope, we're coming up on the Christmas holiday. And so I wish you a happy holiday. And hope all the listeners have a relaxing time as well. We've got something special planned for the next episode, right, Cale?
Yeah, last one of the year, so we'll have something special, so stay tuned and tune in next week.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Cale, for that and for all the links. I'll put them in the show notes.
Thanks, guys. Happy holidays.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.